Well, hey everybody, and man, that was right at the top. I'll try that again because I may have said hey before I actually hit the record button. So we're off to a good start. Hi everybody, welcome to the Fundamentalist Podcast. My name is Elliot Morgan, and I'm here with my podcasting partner Peter Rollins, and this is a podcast we do about all sorts of things, but about life and I don't know, fancy pants, smart stuff sometimes, and really dumb, silly stuff other times. And I do comedy both on the internet and I do it sometimes on stage. I tell jokes occasionally, and Pete does philosophy. He does it by writing books and by doing talks himself. And he's just fresh off the heels of a tour with Mr. Rob Bell, or maybe Dr. Rob Bell, I don't really know, and the Holy Shift Tour. And we are diving in today on the heels of having tried this podcast once.
Yep.
And it was kind of a train wreck. And
well,
so
it was an enjoyable thing, but I felt this morning that there was so much in it.
Yeah.
We could take more time over it.
Yeah, it was less of a train wreck and more so surface level, and sort of like we kind of were both, yeah, you're totally right. Normally I'm the one who pushes for like, let's just put it out, and this is a good call. You were like, no, this can be, there's more to explore here. So anyway, we're going to get into the subject of evolutionary psychology, which I enjoy reading about and I'm a fan of, versus psychoanalysis and sort of Freudian ideas of the unconscious and all this stuff. So I think one of the main things that happened on the last go around was like, excuse me, this is like a very heady conversation. But I think if you've ever grown up in like, if you grew up in the church or if you grew up as a creationist, which I did, and if you've ever then gone from creationism to evolution, and then maybe you're interested in Pete's work, or maybe you're interested in sort of like more mystical stuff where, you know, what's going on behind the scenes of our brains on an unconscious level, all this stuff kind of plays into that a lot. And I think that's really cool. And so I think that's why it's worth discussing in person. It may get a little nerdy, and at times I may, full disclosure, I'm not an evolutionary psychologist. I studied evolution a lot in college because I majored in something called zoology, but I also wasn't very good at it. I just was fascinated by it, and I remember barely any of it. But so if I misspeak or if I mischaracterize stuff, please know that it's, you know, I'm not acting as an expert, but I'm trying to convey certain things. With evolution, you have to use a lot of the right language because some of it's so nuanced. And so anyway, if I mess up, that's going to happen, and we'll start with different theories on each episode. The first episode we're going to do is on the difference between instinct and drive, and if there is a difference, and we're going to discuss that a little bit. And then the second one is going to be more focused on evolutionary psychology, the second episode. Yeah. And then the third episode is going to be how to deal sort of with the quote chaos, or the stuff that I guess evolutionary psychology wouldn't account for. Right.
Yeah, and by the way, you put it beautifully there. So say you grow up, you start off by being a creationist, and if not a creationist, you start by looking at the wonder of the world and thinking that it's a complete mystery with all of these crazy experiences that we can't do justice to. And then as you grow, people, when they become, say, an adolescent, a teenager, then they read evolutionary theory. They get a really good grasp of the mechanisms of life. There's a certain disillusionment of reality, but a positive disillusionment of reality. The only thing I want to argue in these three, you know, kind of episodes is that actually there's a step beyond this where we recover something of creationism that we lose when we go into evolution as a model for understanding humans, that actually weirdly there is an insight in the naive creationist perspective that evolutionary psychology can't take a cord of, and I want to explore what that is.
Yeah, I think that's very cool. It's also very strange. One of the things I said in the last episode was sort of like the idea that it does feel a little bit like mom and dad are fighting at the table when this conversation happens. And so anyway, there will be times where I completely forget what I'm arguing, but yeah, I'm really excited about it. So anyway,
this is almost creationism, evolution versus creationism.
Yes.
You're the evolutionist, exactly. I'm the creationist.
Finally. I've gone full dark side. So anyway, and I do think, and we've talked about this a little bit, but I do think that there are parallels, and I mean, you know this, obviously you write books about it, but there are similarities, it seems like, between psychoanalysis and certain elements of Christianity, and so much as there's just like sort of this, you know. Anyway, we'll get into it. So anyway, let's dive right in. I am going to give a brief summary of how I view evolutionary theory.
Yeah.
All right. And so evolutionary theory is built on basically three things. It's built on random mutation of as a result of reproduction, and that is selected for. So it's selection of errors in your genes or an organism's genes that are become beneficial by chance. And so then what happens is nature or the environment or subatomic influences select for variations that are slightly more beneficial, and over eons and eons and eons, you get macro changes, and you get different species, and you get also microevolution, you get adaptation and all that stuff. And so that is sort of how I view it. I'm a huge Darwin fan, and I think you are too, so this isn't going to be a slam on Darwin, but yeah, and so I believe in natural selection and all this stuff. And so then evolutionary psychology comes into play, which is, and you put this very well yesterday, so I'll let you explain the evolutionary psychology part.
So yeah, absolutely. So evolution is based on repetition, reproduction, adaptation, and survival. Some of those adaptations are more useful to in an environment than others.
Yes.
And that mechanism kind of manifests itself in higher life forms as instinct. So, I mean, and you could almost say there's a kind of proto-instinct in the very nature of evolutionary theory, but instinct is where an animal has an object that it needs, that it wants. When it gets that object, it is satisfied, at least temporarily, and those objects are in the service of them prolonging their life, avoiding death. So life is like a detour in death. There is nothingness, and then life pops up, and then it kind of dies. but over time, evolution makes the detour longer and longer.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we have life forms that can detour death by 100 years,
which
is pretty impressive. And instinct is one of the ways that animals do that. And in evolutionary psychology, here's the common sense notion of the difference between humans and animals, or nature and civilization. So the realm of nature is the realm of instincts, of these three processes operating, basically evolution.
Fight or flight, fight or flight, mate.
And flee, and or was it freeze? They always put freeze in there as well, you know, fight, flight, or
fight,
freeze.
Fight, flight, or freeze.
Yeah, because a lot of animals just stop.
Yeah, and they follow little goats and whatnot, cute goats, scaring the goats. You seen
was
those?
That right?
You scare the goat, and you can, like, the goat, like, freezes and falls over. It's like videos
right?
That's super funny and kind of mean, but yeah.
Oh, that's cute. Yeah, so we have these natural instincts. This is all playing out. And then the common sense story is at a certain point, our brains became so developed, evolved, that some animals went, you know what, we have these instincts. Obviously, this is a mythology, but we have these instincts for, like, mating, for food, for shelter. But sometimes that can cause conflict between us. So I want your shelter, I want your food, I want the one that you're mating with. So we should create rules, laws, a social contract that tries to manage your instincts, that tries to domesticate them so that we can live together and then we can improve. You know, so this is the birth of civilization.
So we as a society, we as a population can continue to procreate and survive,
And also then to develop better means of survival beyond just simple adaptation to the environment. We can manipulate
to further widen that gap between death and death. Nothing in death.
Yeah. So in this story, there is this natural progression of evolution up to a complex brain that allows some animals to create a social contract. And with that law, that social contract that we all by and large abide by, and if you don't, you get punished, civilization, we enter the realm of civilization.
Sure.
The kind of the domestication of instincts in the service of ongoing survival of the species.
Yeah, guiding the instincts, making sure that they don't go haywire, and then thereby creating a environment of safety.
And so within this theory, culture, state, religion should be understood in terms of trying to manage our instincts in various ways, or manipulate our instincts, or try to sublimate them into something useful. So that's an evolutionary psychology, generally way of approaching religion. What is beneficial about religion for the species, or at one stage was. For example, religion might create tribal identity inside and outside. you know, groups that shelter each other, look after
each
other.
Well, also get, I mean, a sense of order, which provides a sense of safety too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a religion, you go, okay, there's a thing, there's a, something happening beyond me, and I'm a part of something. So
exactly. Yeah. So if you read evolutionary theories of religion, you get these kinds of explanations
right.
that are attempting to go, why was this useful in the managing of instinct
yeah.
To service civilization? So this story is completely wrong. Right. That's the problem.
That is fun. Yeah, yeah. I think you're wrong, Pete. So yeah. About that.
This story is very superficial. It misses something very important.
Okay.
It's wrong.
The Lord.
What's that?
The Lord.
The Lord. Exactly.
I mean, in so many, that is kind of what you will argue.
Yeah, yeah. So we're going to spend the rest of the time praying.
Yes.
So what does it miss? Okay, so I'm going to tell now an alternative story.
I can't wait.
Okay.
I can't wait. And this is the best. Buckle up, everybody.
All right.
Wait for this cuckoo ca-choo train. Here we go.
So we can't get into the weeds of it too much right now, but here's the story in brief. Is human beings are evolving, the mechanism's going, instinct is working. Then at a certain point, brains developed complexity. Some brains developed enough complexity to be derailed, a fundamental crisis occurs.
Okay.
Right? And the fundamental crisis can be called psychosis, because psychosis is this weird moment when you start to separate, you start to feel yourself as a self, you start to have self-consciousness, but it's so fragmented, it's so fragile, and it's so fluid that it's chaos. So schizophrenia, of course, is one version of psychosis. But also people hearing voices, being taken over by voices. But what happens then is psychosis is the first step to becoming differentiated, becoming a self. And it is the realm of the horror film. Like if you watch horror movies, they often recreate the psychotic dimension that I'm talking about. So in the last podcast, which we didn't air, I talked about Kubrick and mm-hmm. The Shining. You know, all films have continuity errors. It's funny, you know, you watch these YouTube channels that say all the continuity errors in Jurassic mm-hmm, Park or something, mm-hmm. right? But Kubrick was such an obsessive that he even owns the area of contingency issues. So in other words, he purposefully used contingency errors to create a sense of fragmented reality. So when you watch The Shining, you don't notice it, but there are so many continuity errors that it feels like reality is fragmented.
That's how it was watching Mother.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, what they did with the sound design in Mother is unlike any movie I've ever seen before. And it made me, the girl I was dating at the time, we got into a massive fight after it was, I mean, that, if anything, made me believe in like the how surroundings can just affect your psychology and something. Like it was it put me in a bad place. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they're playing on. Even like very simple things you see in most horror films, which is like, say an individual jumping, mm-hmm. you know, getting closer, but not by walking, but by just like cut
no, scenes. Horrifying. Hate it.
And part of it, you kind of go, why is that so scary? And of course, partly it's because this thing's coming at you very fast, but it's more than that. It's like reality itself feels like it's fragmented. Like mm-hmm. that's not supposed to happen.
I know that feeling. I know that feeling of when they do that, when the thing comes toward the screen, and it is, I hate it so much. Like I know it's just like, it's terrifying to me when they just doom, poof, poof, and I'm like nope, goodbye.
Yeah,
I hate horror movies for the most part anyway, and because I don't like to be scared, but
when you get a horror director who understands implicitly or explicitly the basically it's like recreating a Bosch painting. Do you remember Bosch, who was this painter who painted scenes of hell, uh-huh. and it's all fragmented bodies, people like arms and legs and demons, and they're crazy, but they're kind of like painterly expressions of this psychotic experience, which all infants go through,
sure.
where is there an inside or an outside, where do I start and stop, your ego is totally fragmented. So this is not an evolutionary kind of plus, this is a derailment of evolution. This is a moment where things go seriously wrong.
Okay.
Then what happens is the social contract or law comes in to try to resolve this fundamental perversion of instinct, this fundamental perversion of reality. And what happens is the social contract, in a nutshell, or the law, is designed to differentiate you more from your surroundings, to make you, to kind of basically push you from psychosis into neurosis to make you a self.
Yeah.
And that, and you see this in every infant becoming a child. You see this kind of process, but in psychoanalytic theory, in the history of the evolution, this happened. So in other words, the move from nature to culture isn't this kind of like smooth continuation of evolution. It is the result of a fundamental antagonism, derailment that occurs within subjectivity, the brain, that requires a solution. And so culture, in a sense, is not designed to manage our natural instincts. It's designed to manage our unnatural, perverted instincts. And that's called drive.
Okay.
Okay.
There you go. We're going to get into the drive instinct thing and the differentiation between those two, because I want to hear you explain it, and then I want to promptly disagree.
Yeah.
And then also, I do want to throw this out, and we can cover it more in the next episode if you want, because we're going to focus more on evolutionary psychology in the next episode, I guess. But I do feel like, and I could be wrong here, and I know what you're saying when you use the term derailment, but I do feel like that implies that evolution is this sort of, it's on a track, and it's a train, and it's going toward a particular destination.
Yeah, which is not.
Yeah. And yeah, so evolution or nature does not care if you experience psychosis. Nature does not give a crap. So I think that like there's nothing wrong with an organism existing in a state of psychosis. It's just, it may not survive as well as someone who puts a cap on it. Or
Exactly. It's not a derailment of some sort of progress. It's a derailment of evolutionary theory itself. But what you're saying is very important, which is this nests within evolution. So it's what's called non-reductive, i.e. it arises out of the evolutionary process, but it cannot be adequately addressed by that process. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. It's like this derailment is not something either that derails the kind of the momentum that evolution creates, that continues. And also if this happens within evolution, the difference is evolutionary theory, it cannot adequately address this derailment.
Really, it sounds like what we're saying is that, and because that I agree with, it sounds ultimately like that joke where the scientist is like, science is all that matters, we don't need philosophy. And then the philosopher says, you know, why do you think that? And then the scientist, before he starts talking to the philosopher, goes, oh, you're doing philosophy. Like, it sounds like this is the core of philosophy versus science. Like, it sounds like you're going, to be human cannot be explained by causes of nature that are biological causes of nature. It sounds like, is that what you're saying?
Ultimately? That will explain a lot. That'll actually explain 90% of human action and interaction. But as a theoretical position, until it advances and expands, it won't be able to adequately express what actually makes us humans. So it basically, and this is where it kind of connects with the Islamic, Jewish, and Christian kind of notion of a fall, because in one sense, the Lacan is saying that human subjectivity is a derailment. It is a fall. We fall into self-consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's like the first step. It's not, oh, one day you wake up, look around and go, oh, this is beautiful. It's ontic shock.
Yeah.
It's this moment of like terror, and it's a byproduct of evolution. You know, it doesn't have an evolutionary function. Psychosis, as you say, is actually a problem. It's forever, like an animal that has psychosis will not survive as well as one that doesn't. And so
far as we know, right?
Yeah, well, psychosis, it would throw you into it. You know, we see it because we know psychotic people.
They wouldn't be able to.
Very hard to survive. If you suffer from psychosis, you need institutions to help you survive. You need a lot of help.
Because your instincts aren't. I see. Okay, so even if you're suffering from psychosis, or you're at that stage in human development when you're a baby and you're like you're not gonna be. Your instincts are not going to help you survive at that point.
In fact, that's it. I mean, psychosis, in a sense, is the perversion of your instincts.
Okay, so now I'm kind of back on board a little bit. All right, cool. I got you. So instinct drive.
So it's a fall, a fall into subjectivity.
Yes, okay.
It's a very depressing kind of, like, instead of this kind of, oh, we kind of became so more complex and then we began to speak and it's all wonderful. It's like, oh no, animals were, oh, here's the big thing. Like,
yeah, that's a good point. Because we talked about this a little yesterday. Like, if you imagine just the stages between where we talk, I mean, Freud has that, like, you know, the first person to hurl an insult instead of a rock is the founder of civilization, which I think is like a very cool quote. But at the same time, it's like, imagine all the stages before that where it's like, were we just like, I mean, the barbarism must have just been horrifying. Like,
yes.
I'm reading this book, which we'll get to in a little bit, and little anecdotes in it, and I still want you to read it, but like, there's a story in it about Otzi, who is this this caveman that they found frozen, you know, years and years, you know, eons ago, and they, through science, discovered that he was found at the bottom of like a ravine, and they thought that he had just fallen, and then they found out that no, he had been like attacked and like brutally killed and like all this stuff, very interesting, but it's like, imagine how many people were just get murdered then constantly. If you were, it's like crazy. But anyway,
so I have a very good friend who works in Australia with psychotic patients who have committed crimes, usually very horrific crimes, and you know, but you're being rehabilitated and eventually are going to be able to live in society again.
Whoa.
Under supervision.
There's
incredible violence. There's lots of psychotics and. It's not necessarily connected with violence, but psychosis can be a very destructive form. But the big trick is this. There is violence and antagonism, obviously, in evolution. I mean, the fact that oil exists is the destruction of billions upon billions of creatures. But with subjectivity, the idea is that the antagonism and the violence and the chaos of being, it becomes subjective. It enters into subjectivity, and that's the difference. So with speaking subjects, the chaos of existence and beings, animals fighting animals, but once that chaos enters subjectivity, we are animals that can fight ourselves. We are animals that are split from within. We feel fragmented.
Yeah.
And that early Fun. Stage is, yeah, difficult.
Neat. it's a good time, good time. So, okay, so you have this subjectivity. You have this, Freud comes along and he's like, okay, we have a death drive, and the death drive is this thing that, you know, glutton and, you know, gluttony, and it's basically sinning as what you would describe it in religious terms. But like the excess, the gambler who wastes all their money, the self-destructive, the smoker, the people who are doing things to a point where they are actually actively destroying themselves and sending themselves toward death, not the occasional burger.
Yeah,
that you want, not the you know, fling, but the sex addict, the people who are just destroying their
and this is so I'm not a confessional Christian who I or anything like that. What I'm interested in, but is that I have studied scholastic philosophy, and I'm interested in how some of these terms actually have something very deep in them. So the word sin that you use, I'm like, you know, I want to strip it, of course, of what you learn in kind of Harry Potter type school seminaries and stuff. But kind of go, what is the truth? What is the kernel that's being spoken of in, say, words like sin? And I think, the kernel is this form of activity that is destructive to ourselves and our environment that cannot be explained as an instinct. And that's what Freud called drive. Yeah.
It's very, I mean, if you, that's what, where it gets very cool. Like, you have the first Timothy, whatever, 14, 4:14 or something like that, where it's like, all have fallen, everyone has fallen short of the glory of God and all that. And then, of course, like, what we're basically doing is, or what you're basically arguing is, like, well, human beings, the difference between us and animals is that we experienced a fall. Yeah. We experienced a...
Yeah. This is my fundamental... People think I'm like, you know, if they associate me with any form of Christianity, it's with what's called progressivism or liberalism. And I'm like, no, associate me with fundamentalism before you ever call me a progressive. Because progressivism is like evolutionary psychology. It's this idea that human beings, there is kind of like a... There's a wholeness, evolutionary psychologists have a much deeper kind of whatever, but that there's this kind of human beings, you know, they want to heal, they want to be good. If we raise somebody in a good environment, they'll be nice, they'll be, so it's a kind of sense, it doesn't have a sense of what Freud called death drive.
Yeah.
And I'd love to, let's dive into what that is.
Yeah, and I can absolutely get behind that too. Like, I can get behind the idea of there being, because I mean, statistically, we do do that. Like, it seems like if you look at statistically the amount of people who fall into the death drive to the point of it actually destroying them, I mean, that's a minimal, that's a small amount of people, right? By and large, we do seem to have a inclination toward progress of some kind, or would you disagree with that?
Well, no, I think they both battle within us. So look, let me just, because we haven't probably explained what drive is.
Then. Okay, let's hit that, yeah.
So instinct, you know, we mentioned has three parts. An instinct is, it's a forceful drive for an object. So it has an object, food, shelter, mating, something very concrete. Two, when it gets that thing, it's satisfied. It's like, right, I've eaten, I've mated, I've had shelter. So it satisfies the instinct. Of course, it comes back when it's needed again. Whenever food is needed again, mm-hmm. it comes back. And then thirdly, instinct is in the service of life, as in it detours death. Instinct is a type of mechanism for self-preservation.
Yeah, self-preservation so that you can reproduce, so that your genes can get passed on, so that your species can survive. Yep. Yes. Okay.
So that's instinct. Now, drive is not different from instinct. Drive is perverted instinct. So you have similar elements. But the first thing about a drive is it doesn't have a particular object, right? So a drive, we can have this forceful push for anything. It can't be for food and for shelter, for sex, but it can be for gambling, it can be for increase of money, it can be for love of your car, as in there's people who fall in love with their car, or stamp collecting.
Yeah.
We can have this weird drive
for
literally anything.
Don't bring stamps into this, Pete.
Yeah, that's called the universal addiction, because it's so pointless that it kind of stands in for every addiction.
That's funny. What is scholastic philosophy? What does that mean?
It is basically the study of mostly medieval philosophy, but like ancient philosophy, medieval philosophy.
And what is confessional Christianity?
It is Christianity that, with metaphysics, belief in God, belief in...
monotheistics or traditional Christianity, basically.
Yeah.
How we would think of it in America.
Yeah. What do you see in a church on a Sunday? Catholic. I mean, the main ones are Catholic, Protestant, Evangelical, Orthodox. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And Pentecostal.
And Pentecostal, of course. The truth. The true one.
Yeah. 100% true. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
I like the way you went back to those. That's good. That's good to define those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, you are a gambler.
Yes.
And you get involved. I mean, I don't know, man. Okay.
Well, can I mention the other two very quickly?
And then yes.
So the first is drives can connect to anything. We see people with drives to anything, alcohol, whatever. Secondly, drives aren't satisfied by getting their object. So, for example, if someone has a drive for food, it's different from an instinct for food. You'll eat more than you need, and you'll keep eating, and you won't be satisfied even when biologically you've had enough food. So you're really, or if shelter, if you have a drive for shelter, you'll want a bigger house, you'll want three houses, you'll want a house in a different place. So in other words, shelter is like, oh, you get a place that's adequate for your needs. But the drive you'll always be looking for bigger, different, more.
Mm-hmm.
And then thirdly, drives are not in the service of self-preservation. Because what happens is when we give ourselves over to these drives, we find that they actually cause us to act against our own self-interest. So those are the three reasons why drive looks different from instinct. So now go ahead.
Gambling is a good example. That's great. That was all really good. I'm glad you jumped in there and did that. I feel like this is a fun conversation, but it's so like... I'm trying to wrap my head around it, but like, okay, so totally with like the drive thing, because I see what you're saying, and I also appreciate that you said the internal battle of sort of like these are a conflict that exists with us because we are separated and all that, and so like I think we can all vouch for the reality that as much as we like to say we just want X, Y, and Z, we always will find ourselves you know, having at least an inclination toward excess in some way. But it does the desire at first to buy that house, that shelter, is in and of itself instinctual, right? So like if or the beer, if I want like a glass of whiskey, I know that after that glass of whiskey is done, I will feel safer and I will feel better.
Yeah. Yes, the derailment of instinct doesn't mean that instinct is gone. There's remnants absolutely of that. The kind of, it's almost like the idea that the field of being human, 90% of it can be explained in terms of utilitarianism, in terms of natural selection, etc. It is just this additional percentage, which called drive, that can't be explained by it.
So I guess, in my mind, the way I visualize it is like somewhere, like we all have instinct. Every living organism has instinct to either run or go toward or freeze. But let's just let's say that's minimal and mostly it's run or freeze. And so, or run or go, stay or go. So we all have this thing, every living cell has it. And so we as organisms have it, we as creatures have it. And so that is the fundamental, absolute base level thing that we have at the core of every action. And then you end up in a situation, because we're so smart, because we developed a brain, where we end up enjoying it to the point where we also have this separation happening, right? Because we have consciousness, or we have self-awareness. Hold on, let me. You're ready to go. Okay, so you have this thing, and so then you're like a human being, but you still can't cope with the fact that you have this instinct that's driving you to like have this, and you also know you're separated from it, right? So you know by way of being a human being that you're separated from being an animal, like the dog. If it's hungry, it eats, and if it's not, it sleeps or whatever. But we don't have that. And we want that in some way, so we end up constantly just like getting like excess, because in some way we are wanting to return to a state of not being this fragmented self.
Okay, so I know what you're trying to, like you're trying to maintain, this is definitely an evolutionary perspective, is to try to maintain instinct, that so humans have instinct just like animals. And then what it sounds like I'm saying is, and then there's this additional dimension. But I do want to say that, and I think this is the insight of Calvin. So Calvinism, I think, has a fundamental kind of insight in its notion of total depravity. So in theology, there's a notion of total depravity, which is the idea that, not that we are totally depraved, but that every dimension of our subjectivity is touched by depravity. So if you interpret that in a kind of in a philosophical way, it's saying that every part of subjectivity is tainted with drive. Now, what that means is that human beings don't have pure instinct at all anymore. We have instinct that is perverted by drive.
Okay,
So I'll take an example of food. Human beings can't just eat food the way an animal does. Food becomes so symbolic. Like, for example, in the South, eating meat, which, for example, can be a symbolic statement about being American or something. And in LA, eating kale is you're putting your fingers up to middle America.
Last night I was like, I'm going to order a pizza because I know it just makes me feel like I'm having fun.
Yeah. So there's a symbolic dimension to food. Yes, having fun or it reminds you of your past or whatever. That means that even the most utilitarian thing like food, we eat too little, we eat too much. It's just tainted. It doesn't mean that instinct's not there. Of course, we want to eat to survive and to whatever. But the very dimension of instinct is tainted by drive, which means that it has symbolic forms, it has other things. And ultimately, we can eat not to satisfy our need, but to, because this is what drive does, but to elongate our dissatisfaction, to create this kind of sense of something that could fulfill us, something that could make us whole.
You lost me right at
the
end.
Okay, yeah, I know, because I threw in another dimension. This dimension's, again, it just brings us in a different way, but one of the consequences of the law that attempts to differentiate us, to make us individual, is that it carries with it a sense that we've lost wholeness and completeness. So it means that human beings are marked with a sense of lack, and which means that we often seek something that will complete us, but nothing ever will. That's the problem. So this is the nature of drive. Just one example is that gambling. The gambler, is gambling, and the more they gamble and the more they lose, Like, have you ever, I notice that if I go to Vegas and I throw $10 down, it's fine. But if I lose in the first couple of goes, there's this drive to play more and to bet bigger. The very loss generates a kind of like a desire to kind of go, oh, if only I could win, things would be great. But it never works. So the gambler, even when they win, they gamble more. Mm-hmm. Or the capitalist, no matter how much of the increase of capital you get, if it's a drive, you'll always want more. 1 million to 10 million to 100 million. There is no end to the drive. But the drive is attempting to find this wholeness that's always receding.
You have, I mean, okay, so we talked about a little bit, there's this, in this book I'm reading, there's this experiment, and I think this is, there's a point, I'm going to throw out some terms here, because it might come out a little bit jumbled, but the first is there's the term addictive personality, and it does seem like at times what you're saying is the differentiation between something that's instinctual or part of a drive is, unless you're saying there's just no instinct, or, like that everything is drive
I am saying everything's drive, only in a sense of total depravity. This is one of my issues with some of the evolutionary psychologists that I've seen, like, is that there seems to be this idea that there is instinct that is not touched by this fundamental derailment. That is, one word for it could be, you know, psychosis. So there is instinct, but it's not. So that's why it's called drive. It's called drive because it arose out of instinct. And it has lots of dimensions of instinct, but it's not quite instinct anymore. It's something else.
Okay.
But so, I like the idea of total depravity. It's almost like, think about, like, the drive has touched instinct. So now it's no longer simply in the service of life.
Yeah. And this happens in every human being, you're saying. You're arguing.
Yes,
but unless you're human, the average, I guess.
Yes, yeah, because if you suffer from psychosis, your experience will be very different. So, but for the typical neurotic, yes, yeah.
So, cool, mm-hmm. Love it, very fun. We talked about in this book I'm reading. There's this experiment that they did where they, using sort of the argument of we are driven by, at our core, sort of unconscious, instinctual things that is always sort of like, to the point that they were doing these experiments where they would show that just the act of bringing things closer to you makes you more amenable to them, and pushing them away makes you not like them, mm-hmm. even if you're not consciously aware that that's what you're doing. So they ran these experiments where...
So basically, just to clarify, you have some stuff. If I push chocolate away from me, if I'm always like, when I get chocolate, I push it away, mm-hmm. somewhere unconsciously, I am telling myself that I don't like it. Mm-hmm. But if I pull it towards me, mm-hmm. unconsciously, I'm going to be more attracted to it, mm-hmm. right?
And, which plays into, like, you know, they say that if you pick up an object at the store and you hold it in your hand, you're like 70% more likely to buy it. Like, it's yours, you know, and there's that possession. Well, I don't know if that's actually the same thing. But anyway, so they did this experiment, and it was a series of experiments that kind of built on each other over several decades. But it got to a point where the version of the experiment they did, first they did things where they, just to test this theory, they would have one group where they would show bad things, and they would say, if it's a bad thing, if it's something that repulses you or something, push the lever away from you. And they're like, if it's something that you like, pull it towards you. So it'd be like hug, kiss, and then like these flashcards would pop down, you know, and it would be like famine, war, anger, and you would push that away. Mm-hmm. They did the same experiment where they had, if it was a good thing, they had them push it away. If it was a bad thing, they had them pull it. The people who had to pull for something that was bad took longer to do across the board. And so that was sort of like the beginning of that experiment back in like the 70s or something. And then they built on it. And then there was a more advanced version that the author of the book did, where basically they took a group of alcoholics and they separated one group into a control group and then another into the experimental group. And the experiment group, they basically, rather than go push means bad and pull means good, they completely stripped them of that. And they just said, on every other image, mm-hmm. Push or pull. So you just switch every time. Or it was like on the purple cards, pull, and on the yellow cards, push or something. And then they would write different words. I don't remember exactly how they did it. But the reality, or the point was, the people did not know that they were the hypothesis was that you could literally like prime people based on their instincts, the core instincts to push or pull to either fight or flight, that you could actually change their perspective or their inclination toward drinking. And so the group, lo and behold, that found themselves, because what they would do is they go, okay, yellow card means pull. So on the yellow card, they would not put any alcohol. On purple card, they would put a cocktail. So these people are just pushing away cocktails and alcohol and stuff. Those people had a better success rate of not relapsing than the people who didn't. And so the argument is basically, at our core, there is an instinct. We can actually use this knowledge on a fundamental level to generate substantive changes in people's lives.
Yeah.
I would argue, and this could be totally whatever, it still wasn't like night and day. It wasn't like these people who pushed alcohol away were better. It was something like 10 or 15% better, which, you know, doesn't sound like a lot, but then you're like, the author is like, those are people with families, yada. And I'm like, yeah, that's really cool. My argument would be, those were people who were like instinctively drawn toward alcohol. Yeah.
This is a good example of scientists doing experiments that we already know what the answer is going to be, but it's still good that they do it because it's good to have actual data.
So, I don't know. You think you would expect that?
100%. Well, we do this every day. Well, not every day, but if you don't go to the pub, because you go, like, if I go to the pub, I'll maybe drink a bit and I'll end up eating McDonald's and, you know, I'll end up like, you know, doing stuff that's destructive.
What you told me Tuesday night. Yeah.
So I mean, we all know that there's an instinct, well, like, that we can have that push both consciously and unconsciously ourselves away from the things that we know will be destructive.
But that's different. That's conscious though.
I'm saying consciousness, but also unconsciously, we know that there's times where, you know, you just get tired before you go out, and it's, you don't know this because it's unconscious, but it can be a way for you to protect yourself from the things that you might do if you go out. But I like the experiment in a sense of, I think it's absolutely true, is that there is an element of us that wants to avoid the destruction of drive. And you see it when you go gambling, and there's a part of you when you go on tilt. So it's called, as you know, for gamblers, on tilt is when you lose and then you throw good money after bad. Mm-hmm. Now, people think that on tilt just means you just want to get your money back. But the psychology of tilt is that when you lose, not consciously, but unconsciously, the win becomes even more important to you. So, you know, that's why casinos always win. It's not just because they've got a 1% advantage.
When that happens, that's when you got to go home, man.
Exactly. Well,
when Vegas stops being real fun at that point. It does not. I know that feeling, and that's not a good feeling.
And that's why I said in the previous thing is that most gamblers aren't addicted to winning, they're addicted to losing.
Yeah.
Because if you lose in the first couple of gambles, you're more likely to get too involved. Whereas if you win the first couple, you'll go like, oh, let's go for a drink.
Yeah.
Oh, I won $50, let's go for a drink. But you lose $50 in the first 5 minutes, the drive can kick in and you can start to like give yourself to it.
Those first few bets are very important. You know, we got to stop talking about Vegas. We have to stop.
And we just have to go.
I have a drive inside. I don't know what it is, Pete, and I just want to gamble my life away. And we can talk more about this evolutionary psychology thing later, because right now all I want to do is gamble until I die.
I know, we need to go. But so this experiment, what I'm saying is that, yeah, it shows that there is this dimension to us unconsciously that, you know, wants to try to fight against this drive. But that's exactly what the law is. That's what I'm saying is telling us what we already know, which is the law came in as a way to protect us from this destructive drive. So the law is basically saying no. So when you push that alcohol away, that is no. That's basically, it's yes, no. This is Freud called it the Fort Dagium, where this child got basically a spool of wool, threw it away, and then pulled it back. And you see a lot of kids play this game of pushing and pulling. And so, of course, the push is the no, the refusal, and the pull is the desire. So the law is exactly what I think this experiment is showing, which is human beings have had to develop prohibitions and things that are designed to protect us from the devastation of the drive.
Wait, are you saying that the pushing and the pulling is part of that?
Yeah, so like the pushing and pulling is part of it, because there's a sad thing where the more we can't have something, it can also generate the desire to have it.
Okay, but I would say the push and the pull thing is so basic to the that to life itself.
Well, yeah, that's it. That's why Freud was like looking at this infant. So what the experiment's doing is, in a sense, it's a Fort Da game. Mm-hmm. It's the people are pushing the lever, pulling the lever. So they're replicating a very basic structure, which is the structure of the law, the attempt to manage this psychosis. So I would say I think actually in retrospect, because we talked about it last night and I didn't think about it, but I think this experiment is a good way of explaining what the law is attempting to do.
Where I get lost in this conversation is the argument itself.
Yeah.
And I think where we may be speaking different languages is like, I can't honestly like believe that. You've agreed with this. Like, the reality is that the drive, the human, the whatever, the derailment, as you would call it, did spring forth from evolutionary processes in some way.
Yeah, I mean, we're not, the difference is, I mean, well, obviously, like,
yes.
But
then human nature, though, itself, why we are the way we are, cannot be viewed as like, well, the tiger does this, and therefore this is just this version of the tiger doing that, or like the oak tree that, you know, dumps a thought, like you're talking about autoerotic asphyxiation, not in relation to this, just because you have weird hobbies, but like you were saying that like it was this idea that, you know, autoerotic asphyxiation is basically the reason people do it is because right before death you want to spread your seed and like reproduce as much as possible.
That's you know, one evolutionary psychological explanation for that behavior, which is just laughable.
Just so, I mean, even from like, as a fan of people who just like say evolutionary psychological theories, like that just sounds like, anyway.
When there are actually very good explanations, but it's a lot of fun.
It's super fun. Just say what it is. Yeah. Call it by
name. Basically, what we talked about at the beginning is so important, which is you say you start off as a creationist, then you become an evolutionary biologist, and then the third step is to go, oh, there was a dimension to creationism that was right. Of course, creationism is not correct, and evolutionary theory is, but is the best explanation we have. But that actually,
you're
there's
some
a dimension.
Bold things here on this episode of The Fundamentalists, everybody.
What's that?
You're saying some bold things here.
Yeah. Am I? This is bold, yes. Yeah. Because what I'm saying is
the thing about creationism, it's not correct, but
although in one sense I'm saying it's more correct than evolutionary psychology. Like, that's why I call myself a creationist rather than an evolutionary psychologist, because for me creationism is actually closer to the truth, but we have to uncover it. Can I give you the perfect example of this?
You know, I know why it's closer to the truth. Any poem, any existentialist is going to say that the artistic, poetic sort of like interpretation of human life is going to be more compelling and more than the scientific.
The existentialist will say not because it's more beautiful and it makes us enjoy sunsets, but they'll want to say, but there's actually a philosophical reason.
Okay.
And we'll get to, you know, so this is not my example. I think it was Jacques-Alain Miller, who's a French thinker. He talked about this experiment where they got some scientists, crazy scientists, right, got mice and put the mice in a cage. And in the cage, they put really good food in one corner behind a barrier. So the mice could see the really good food, but they couldn't get to it. And then freely accessible, they had some kind of rubbish food. So what happened is the mice tried to get the good food. They bounced against the screen. Mm-hmm. When they kind of realized they couldn't get it, they went and they ate the bad food. If anyone has a dog, they know exactly this thing. You have a dog and it pulls on the leash to go one direction, but you tug it enough and it eventually walks the way, you say. But then the scientists took the mice out and they basically zombified them. They derailed them. They screwed with their brains and put the mice back in. And now the mice would bash against the glass partition until they died. They wouldn't renounce the good food. So what the scientists had done is they'd made zombie mice, because a zombie is pure drive without desire. We haven't covered desire, forget that. But pure drive. So like a zombie will go for flesh, even if you shoot it, it just won't stop. Mm-hmm. And the alien out of Aliens, Zizek talks about this, the alien is an animal of pure drive. There is just this unrelenting pursuit. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea, is that this, what the scientists did is, in a sense, they didn't adapt the brain, they kind of short-circuited it, and now the mice didn't renounce what they wanted. That's drive. There is a certain point in subjectivity, or that is subjectivity, where human beings can get so attached to something like money that they will continue to pursue more and more and more without limit until their own destruction. This is why Ayn Rand is wrong, actually. One of the reasons is that Ayn Rand says that the increase of capital is selfish. This is an evolutionary idea as well, that we do it because we want more, because we can have more shelter, more food, more mating, all of that. But the Freudian notion is that, no, if you meet really good capitalists, they're often selfless, but they're selfless in a perverse way, a zombified way. They can't stop, to the detriment of, they'll betray their friends. They'll promise things and then betray. They'll get rid of their families. They'll give themselves heart attacks, and they'll know it. Yeah. And they'll know that 100 million, 200 million, in fact, not only does it not get satisfied, the more money they have, the more they think about money. That's drive, that's instinct gone wild. Mm-hmm. Turned up to 11. My only cultural reference. Yeah, so I'm going to try and get title. It into every episode.
Yeah. Just imagine that, but like turned up to 11. All right, cool. Yeah, no, I like it. I like the conversation. I think we're good. I think the instinct and the drive thing, we're going to explore more of that in the coming episodes. I think if I had a takeaway, it's that, I think it's a very interesting conversation. I love a lot of what you're saying. I still am just not, I still feel like evolutionary psychology has a lot to offer, but do think that in terms of what it is to be human, why it is that we are the way we are, and why we all deal with these internal chaoses, I think is better answered by the existentialists and the poets and the Genesis and the creation stories and all that, the mythos and all that. Like I do find beauty in that, you know, but there's all, I just also like, yeah, the evolution stuff. I enjoy these theories that are, that, you know, oh, well, this is because this, any really answer that, attempts to answer the question of why, I think is a very, very interesting, very good.
I totally agree with you, because here's the thing I want to distance myself from. I'm not into poetry. I'm not into mythology as a way of describing truth. That actually, I'm, you know, that's a kind of neo-Jungian kind of thing that I'm not into. I can enjoy a little bit of mythology, but what I want to do is have precision. So my argument is actually, I want what you want. I love the precision of science and philosophy. Yeah. My argument is that it's not precise enough.
Yeah.
That and that we can actually have more precise mathematical descriptions of subjectivity that do justice to this.
That will be, maybe we can cover that in the next one, sort of the inability to experiment or prove or hypothesize with psychoanalysis beyond I know you have the argument of like being the individual, and the individual being its own sort of thing by nature, you can't sort of quantify it, right? And that's sort of the Freudian thing where it's like that the very basis of psychoanalysis is that it's like patient, you know?
Yeah, although I think you can apply this to kind of groups as well. Cool. I'm kind of with you, and my takeaway is, again, to go like, the argument is that evolutionary theory is an incredibly brilliant, sophisticated theory, one of the best of the 20th century, you know, one of the best in the intellectual life of the planet.
It's the best. Yeah. I mean, I do think it's like evolution and psychoanalysis from my
in the 20th century. I think they are two of the big innovations. I think in physics, you know, you have the bigs. You have Darwin, you have Freud, you have Nietzsche, you know, you have these,
so cool.
Yeah, these big thinkers, and they're very important. The key takeaway for me is more that for that evolutionary psychology would benefit from engaging with the theoretical perspectives of the French philosophical tradition, and vice versa. So the philosophical and continental philosophy tradition would really benefit from deep dives into kind of the advances being made in neurobiology, etc. But that, I suppose, I mean, I'm coming more from one side, so I go like the other side needs to take into consideration the theorizing around drive. But of course, actually, I can see the other perspective, which is that philosophical tradition needs to also engage with neuroscience.
And, yeah, and it's, I mean, happening. Scientists are, I know that they look upon that field as sort of like, oh, you guys are just a bunch of kooks, just yeah. a bunch of like, oh yeah, it's all this stuff. And you're like, oh, I know it's about this,
and
yeah, like,
and then both sides then get into that, and then it's a fight, and mm-hmm. then both sides hate each other. And there's thank God there are some theorists, like I think Catherine Malibu is a very good one, who actually transgress those battle lines.
Yeah, cool.
And so I don't want to sound like I'm trying to draw those battle lines even stronger. Talking to you, I'm going like, no, you're reminding me that there's a really interesting space of crossover where, again, it's the creationist, the evolutionary biologist, and then we enter into this third stage where we do justice to these notions of derailment and fall and drive.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's also an offshoot of the world we live in with the internet and everybody being very like, it's so easy to fall into the trap of like, no, everything has an answer and everything is fact and we have to go by this and then we have to go by that. And it's like, you know, it's like about logic and, you know, logic, yeah. logic.
No, but that's me. That is me. I'm logic, totally. Logic more than you then, because for me, my argument is just, it's not sophisticated enough. So Lacan in his later life created these incredibly difficult mathematical schemas that are, so I am all logic.
Totally. My argument is only that the logic people, the culture that we're, I mean that on a cultural sense.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That there's this movement toward like facts, and we're also obsessed with this idea that empirical truth is this like attainable thing. And it seems to me that a step that is necessary to be taken is one in which you go, oh no, there is a like, there's a level of conflict and chaos that can't be resolved at the core of, yeah. of existence. And that's not being yeah. accounted for.
But I would say the problem is actually just that, sadly, you can't learn too much from YouTube videos. Like a lot of people who are into facts are reading these books that they're like popular books on, you know, on physics or psychology or philosophy. They're great. They get to the number one
popular science.
Science. And actually, when you get to what's called ontology, you can still get this on YouTube. There are some great philosophers. There's actually a guy called Gregory Sandler, I think his name is, who's very good. Who's YouTubing the entire book of Hegel's called The Phenomenology of Spirit, one of the hardest philosophical yeah. texts. And he's doing it in half an hour chunks. He's got about 300 videos so far. And by the time he finishes, there'll be like 500 half hour videos.
That's very cool.
Doing paragraph by paragraph. So my issue is, I think it was Francis Bacon who said, a little bit of philosophy is dangerous. You know, so but the people who often are into facts, they do enjoy watching YouTube videos, reading the popular book. But here's the thing, is that, and this is what I want to encourage people to do in my work, is you have to go deeper and you have to start reading books that you don't understand. Don't read below your intellectual ability. That's what most of us do. Read above your intellectual ability. Read a book that is fundamentally, you have to stop every couple of paragraphs and look things up and read another article and do this. That's the way you progress. So my issue is actually when I watch Joe Rogan show or whatever, and he has these academics, that the problem is just the people who like these people have not done enough work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the and you need those people because they usher people into that world.
Yes.
But it's very easy to reach a place of comfort and safety because of our instincts driving us.
Because I'm a vulgarizer. Vulgarizing is taking complex ideas and bringing them into popular things. So I want to be a vulgarizer. I'm a big fan of it.
Cool
but,
word.
But the trick is, are you a vulgarizer who then kind of like gets people to start doing their own research? So I always want to have enough questioning in the audience that they go, I'm going to do my own research. Or are you a vulgarizer that's basically saying, you don't need to read these other people.
Yeah.
Just do what I say and you're fine.
Yeah.
So that's my problem is that, of course, we need the popularization of ideas, but not as an end in itself, as a means to going deeper.
Mm-hmm. And most people just want to learn enough so that they can justify being mad at their parents.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.